This is Mid-Morning on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Carrie Miller. This hour, what the GI Bill delivers and doesn't. In the next several weeks, Congress is slated to vote on a new GI Bill that has given all the rhetoric around supporting the troops surprisingly controversial. Among budget hawks, some veterans, the White House, even the presumptive Republican nominee Senator John McCain. And here's why. The bill, authored by Virginia Senator Jim Webb, a Democrat who served in Vietnam, would provide enough help to active duty veterans to pay tuition and living expenses for 4 years at a public college. Reservists who'd served 2 years of active duty would also be eligible for the benefit. But criticism of the new GI Bill began to build when the Department of Defense, President Bush, and some members of Congress learned it would cost more than $50 billion over the next decade. Still, that's not the only opposition. Some believe that the educational benefits are so generous that enlistees will sign up for the minimum stint to get them and then get out of the military to get their degrees. Supporters of the bill say this is what's owed to the men and women who fought the ongoing wars and that the country will reap the rewards of so many newly educated citizens. We're going to examine those arguments, the arguments on both sides, with our guests this morning. We're also going to talk about some of the other incentives the military is using to persuade people to sign up and how those incentives have changed and expanded since the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan began. So our guest for the hour, Paul Rykoff, is Executive Director of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, and he's with us for part of the conversation from Washington. Paul, always good to have you on the show. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Good to be with you.
Later in the hour, Cindy Williams is going to be with us. She's a research scientist with the Security Studies Program at MIT, and she's author of the book Filling the Ranks. And for our listeners, if you're serving in the military, you're a veteran, we'd like to hear from you this morning. Are you planning a college education when you get out? Did you use the GI Bill money to get your degree? What do you think of this argument that the Pentagon is making, that the more money you provide for college, the less incentive there is to stay in the military? So if you're a veteran, you've served in the military, maybe you have family members that serve in the military, I'd like to hear your views on this. What do you think about this idea of providing 4 years of tuition at a public institution and living expenses? What about this argument that opponents are making that if you make these education benefits generous like this, people will go into the military, serve the minimum stint, and get out to get their degrees? 800-242-2828. If you're listening in the metro area, 651-227-6000. If you're online this morning, minnesotapublicradio.org, and click on Send a Question. Paul, I understand you're in New York, not Washington. So
that's right.
Thanks for being with us there. You told a reporter recently, funding the GI Bill as Senator Webb proposes it for 1 year would cost this country what it spends in Iraq in 36 hours. If that's true, why is this an increasingly hard sell?
You know, that's a great question for the people opposing it. The current version of the GI Bill that will go into the supplemental this week, the supplemental for the war, will come in at under $1 billion for the first year. So that's pretty small in comparison to the over $100 billion that the Congress will likely allocate for the war. It's also about a quarter of what we spend on recruiting annually for the military. We spend about $4 billion to bring men and women into the military as new recruits. So, you know, over time, is it a little more costly? Yes. But I think investing in a new generation of young men and women is a really worthy investment and will ultimately produce a tremendous return, not only for those individuals, but for our entire country. We saw with the original GI Bill that was set up after 1944 that for every dollar invested into GI Bill recipients, about $7 was returned to the national economy in terms of productivity and other benefits. So it's not just a handout. It's definitely an investment in our young men and women coming home from combat.
Let's clarify for our listeners what the current education benefits that you get right now under the existing GI Bill. How much money do you get, and why the argument that it doesn't go far enough?
Well, right now, the GI Bill only covers about 60 to 70% of the average cost of a four-year public college or university and less than about 2 years of the typical private college. National Guardsmen and reservists, including those who've served multiple combat tours, only receive a fraction of the benefit offered to active duty service members. There's also considerable delays in receiving benefits. More than 118,000 VA education claims are right now waiting to be processed. And this is on top of the fact that veterans have to pay a non-refundable $1,200 contribution up front to even qualify for the GI Bill. So the GI Bill is not what our grandfathers had when they came home from World War II, which covered tuition, fees, books, and gave veterans a living stipend, and ended up sending about 8 million veterans to higher education. It produced our middle class and produced a generation of amazing leaders like Gerald Ford, Herbert Walker Bush, Senators Bob Dole, Pat Moynihan, even authors like Norman Mailer and Frank McCore. They all came from the GI Bill. I think it was about 14 Nobel Prize winners, two dozen Pulitzer Prize winners ultimately came out of that robust GI Bill. But the one we've got now is really just a shell of that World War II style GI Bill.
You know that we'll get to this argument about getting in and making these education benefits attractive enough that people want to get out. But you also know that opponents say that we are not where we were in World War II as far as pay bonuses go, that with what people who go into the military are making with regular pay and then bonuses on top of it, that it isn't like it was when Frank McCourt, Norman Mailer getting out of the service and during World War II and having to pay for a college education. People are more able to do it these days.
Well, I don't know if they are. I mean, now you've got folks doing third and fourth deployments. More than 500,000 people have been to the combat theater more than once. Many of them are National Guardsmen and reservists. In a state like Minnesota, you've got tens of thousands of people who've left their jobs and their families behind as guardsmen and reservists to go fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. Coming home, they face a multitude of new issues, and I think the most important one is that the country, for the most part, is disconnected in a way they weren't after World War II. Right now, we've got folks coming home that make up less than one-half of 1% of the American population compared to about 12% after World War II. So if we're going to ask such a small number of people to continue to serve over and over again, I think putting them at least on the same footing we had after World War II is the honorable thing to do, and I would argue it's also the smart thing to do in terms of the social investment and the readiness and health of our military overall.
I want to take some calls while you're with us, since you can be with us here for 30 minutes or so. Paul Rykoff, joining in the conversation this morning, Executive Director of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, with us from New York, as we talk about the debate that's going on in Washington over this GI Bill, the education benefits. Some think it's too expensive. Some are worried about reenlistment rates if you dangle very nice education benefits. And we'll get to that in just a moment. But I'm asking our listeners, if you're a veteran, if you're serving in the military right now, if you have friends and family serving in the military, your thoughts on the education benefits. I'm curious if some of you used your GI Bill education benefits to get your degrees. What about the truth, though, and share your perspective with us on this, of the Pentagon's concern that you'll have fewer and fewer people reenlisting at a time when recruiting is getting more difficult. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. If you're online today, MinnesotaPublicRadio.org, and click on Send a Question. We have full phone lines here, so you can join us online, and we will get to your call. Be patient with us. To David in Litchfield. Hi, David. You're on Mid-Morning.
Hi, thank you. There are some downsides, I imagine, to offering these kind of benefits. But on the upside, I'm thinking back to the 70s when I enlisted, and I enlisted because there was this GI Bill benefit. I turned out to be a top linguist. I was a Vietnamese interpreter in the war. And so it's possible, if you just need warm bodies, maybe you don't want to offer great benefits, but you might actually bring in people who are really heading someplace, and this is one way to get there. I'm thinking also, when I came out of the military, came back from the Vietnam War, my reentry into society was so different from what it would have been if I had not had the benefits. So
if you weren't able to go to college, David, it would have been more difficult to get
much, much harder. And it got me through 2 years of college and a few years of grad school. I'm a minister now. And the reentry was so much better. And I really think it's a tremendous benefit throughout life, both in the recruitment stage, during the military, your morale is better, and then afterwards you have a break.
Paul, give us some thoughts on what David has said about that, the reentry part of that.
GI Bill makes sense. The reentry issue is a critical one, and I'm glad he brought it up. We know that about 1 in 4 veterans are coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan with some kind of a mental health injury, like post-traumatic stress disorder, severe depression. We know that they're coming back at times to a tough financial situation, tremendous stress from the family, and just general readjustment issues. And after World War II and throughout the GI Bill's existence, it's provided a safe space. It's provided a really effective reintegration tool to allow people to focus on bettering themselves and at the same time dealing with all the readjustment issues in the confines of a pretty safe environment, a college protective area. And I think the recruiting issue is also an important one. We know that the number one reason why people join the military is for the educational benefits. And the bottom line is right now, folks think when they join the military, college is paid for. But the reality is it's not. The total GI Bill for 4 years comes out to about $39,000 right now. So as anyone who's checked the price of college knows, that's really peanuts compared to what you need to cover the cost of education. So the recruiting effort is really going to be enhanced tremendously by a new GI Bill.
But Paul, in some ways you are making the argument for the other side, though, too. If you're joining up for educational benefits, doesn't it stand to reason that you're going to do the minimum that you have to do and get out to take advantage of those educational benefits that you joined up for?
I don't think I am. I think that's a short-sighted argument.
Why?
I think that's by saying, well, you know, Senator Kaka, who's a decorated World War II vet, spoke on Capitol Hill just last week, and he said, you know, we can't retain people that we don't recruit. And the bottom line is that we're having a real hard time bringing people in at all right now. And the GI Bill, we know, will be the most effective way to bring people in. And we may see some erosion to recruiting to retention over time. That may be true. We haven't seen any statistics from the Department of Defense or anyone else that really substantiates that. But the overall net gain to bringing in this new generation of folks who I would argue are coming to the military for better reasons. You're probably going to get folks who are more upwardly mobile. And while they're in the military, National Guard and reservists are going to be taking advantage of the GI Bill. So it's not just folks who leave the military and go back to their civilian life. It's going to be folks who continue to serve and maybe go back for a second or third deployment with the reserve component. So I think that argument that basically the benefits are going to be too good and everybody's going to get out, it doesn't hold weight for me. We haven't seen that to be the case. And I think it really just is a sign of kind of desperation on the part of the DOD because we haven't seen it. Basically they're saying don't give them too good benefits because then they're going to want to get out.
And they have to be, I mean, it's their job to be worried about recruitment and reenlistment, right?
It is, but I think, you know, it's also their job to think about the integrity of the force. And I don't know too many people right now that are leaving the military because the educational benefits are getting so good. They're leaving because of repeated deployments. They're leaving because of stress on the family. They're leaving because they want to go back to school or do something else entirely. Not everybody wants to be a career officer. And I think for the folks that do want to come in for 2 or 3 years, serve their country like so many did after 9/11 and go on to the rest of their lives, I think they deserve adequate benefits. So a National Guardsman who was wounded in Iraq, maybe lost his leg, is he entitled to less benefits on the educational side than someone who did 10 years over time? We don't think so. We think anybody who served deserves to go to college. That's part of holding up our end of the bargain as a population.
All right, back to the phones to Marie in Fargo. Marie, thanks for waiting. Question, comment for us.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment concerning the fact that I think people that are stateside and those that serve in the states and don't see any overseas deployment are maybe reaping the benefits a little too much. And I have seen people that have come back from overseas that are wounded and, like you said, have had stress on their families. And they don't receive the adequate benefits, whether it's educational or not. And I feel like the money is being flooded in the wrong direction because I know many people that are stateside here and that are in college, and they're living too good of a life that people who work 4 jobs don't have, and I just don't think it's fair. And I think the money's just being flooded in the wrong direction, and we need to take care of those that have been overseas 2 or 3 times more than those that are here stateside.
Paul, thanks, Marie, very much for the call. Paul, is there an argument to be made that these benefits should be more targeted? As Marie says, not across the board, but you give them to people that, you know, signed up for 2 reenlistments or saw combat, or, you know, you measure, you have different standards for the amount of time and the places that you were when you were in the military.
Sure. Sure, but then you create different classes of soldiers. And I think that that's a dangerous path to go down. The GI Bill, as it's set up now under Senator Webb, would be available to any member who served at least one day of active duty after 9/11 and has an honorable discharge. That would create an even playing field for everyone. And I think we've got to be careful of forcing our soldiers to fight over scraps.
Well,
a soldier sitting on a tunnel system, for example, here in New York, guarding the Lincoln Tunnel against terrorist attack, is still, you know, under danger. Maybe not as much as someone who's on patrol in Fallujah, but I don't think we want to differentiate someone who's here stateside doing Homeland Security versus someone over there. At the end of the day, we should be able to send any man and woman who raises their right hand to defend their country to college.
One of the concerns that the director of the National Military Family Association has, that if you put this much money into educational benefits, the money will come from somewhere else. She's worried that military families, you know, will suffer in some other way because, given the state of the budget, there just isn't enough money to do it all.
Well, that's up to Congress, and I don't think that anybody.
But are you concerned about that?
Well, they should be concerned about it, I guess, in the old dynamic where, you know, wives and husbands had to fight against World War II veterans for benefits. But we've seen the largest funding increase in 77 years to the VA. So what's really changed is the entire framework of thinking with regard to veterans affairs in Washington. Vietnam veterans shouldn't be worried that if a benefit is given to Iraq veterans that they're going to lose something. There should be enough money and enough resources available that every veteran and every veteran's family is treated appropriately and resourced accordingly. If they have to take away money, it should be from Bridges to Nowhere or some other pork barrel spending projects that Congress has entertained. I mean, there are plenty of places for them to cut the budget to find this money. And I think one other thing I want to emphasize that's really important, this legislation is supported by every major veterans organization in America, the VFW, the American Legion, Reserve Officers Association, Military Officers Association. The American Legion and VFW didn't agree on the original GI Bill in 1944, so we've seen an unprecedented alliance here. In addition to 59 members of the Senate, the majority of the House, one-third of the House Republicans, basically everybody who lives this and has entertained this on the civilian side and the veterans and military affairs community is behind this bill. The opposition is really coming from a very small select group of people. It's the DOD, it's the White House, it's Senator McCain and a few co-sponsors on his bill. So it really does have an amazing coalition of nonpartisan leaders together to push for a new GI Bill.
To be clear, it's not so small, and that's a powerful group of people that you named that oppose this. The Pentagon, the DOD, the Department of Defense, Senator McCain.
Well, Senator McCain has 18 co-sponsors on his bill. They're all Republicans. Some of them are also signed on to Senator Webb's bill with 58 others. Over 266 members of the House have now signed on. I think there are only two other pieces of legislation in all of Congress that have more co-sponsors on the House side. The DOD has opposed this, sure, but the DOD doesn't have to answer to veterans once they leave the service in the same way these elected officials do, and I think the American people do. So, you know, in the end, we hope that the DOD will drop their opposition here or find ways to compromise. But this is clearly moving forward. It's got tremendous momentum. There's been a historic alliance put together. And I think a lot of people who are running for re-election this November need to think about whether or not they want to be on the right side of this or the wrong side of this.
Well, I wondered if you think this will be a political issue during the campaign.
It already is, and that's unfortunate. But I think the reality is we've got 26 million veterans in America of all generations. There are over 400,000 veterans in Minnesota alone. And they vote. They pay attention. And when somebody goes back to their district this year and says, I voted against the GI Bill because it was too expensive, I don't think that's going to play over very well at the local VFW hall.
800-242-2828. If you're among those veterans, you're listening in this morning, you'd like to weigh in, we'd like to hear it. 651-227-6000 online at MinnesotaPublicRadio.org and click on Send a Question to Len in St. Paul. Hi, you're on Mid Morning. Your question or comment for us?
Yes, good morning. I was in Vietnam 70-71. Mm-hmm. I was drafted. I was one of those guys that Donald Rumsfeld said didn't make very good soldiers, but everybody's entitled to their opinion, I guess. Anyway, this deals with the retention issue. It seems to me the one thing that I've been very concerned about is how many Special Forces soldiers, Special Ops guys, Navy SEALs are concluding their enlistment and instead of re-enlisting are going into Blackwater where they could make you know, 10 times what they're making. What's that doing to our retention? That's another little White House policy that has concerned me. So I'd be interested in your guest's opinion. I'll take my answer
off
the air.
Thanks for the call. Paul, what do you know about that?
Well, let me speak from my personal experience, because I'm still in the individual ready reserves in the National Guard. I don't know anybody who's left the National Guard to go take advantage of the incredibly robust educational benefits that currently exist. I have four soldiers right now that serve with me in Iraq who are working for contractors overseas. So I think for most of the folks who have served in Iraq and Afghanistan, this argument about the GI Bill impacting retention just doesn't hold water. I think your guest brings up an important point. Contractors are another factor that's negatively impacting retention in a very strong way, especially within the special forces community, where it could take years of American taxpayers' dollars, 2-3 years to train a Green Beret or a Navy SEAL. And they're being poached by Blackwater, KBR, and a variety of other contractors. So there are a lot of forces at play here. And I think that this focus on the GI Bill as a retention erosion piece, I think, is really kind of hollow.
Paul, when Cindy Williams joins us here in a few minutes, we're going to talk about some of the bonuses and the incentives that the military is using to bring more people in their recruiting efforts. But concerns have been raised about the quality of the people that are responding to the incentives and joining the military. You worry about that?
I do, absolutely. I think all of us who have been in the military and still are concerned about the reductions in quality. About 10% of our current force wouldn't have been in a few years ago because we've relaxed educational standards. We've raised the age of enlistment up to 42 years old. There have been some felony waivers. And what ends up resulting for that young platoon leader or company commander is that when you have a person who has those types of issues, they often become the problem child in the platoon or the company.
That's what I wonder. Day to day.
Yeah.
What does it mean on the battlefield? Were there. What's it mean?
It means discipline problems. It means physical fitness issues. It means paperwork, backlogs. It's just a lot more work for that problem child in your unit. And it takes away a limited amount of time from your other soldiers and your other missions. Now, some of them rebound well. Don't get me wrong. Some of them can have a second chance and a second life and really do well in the military. But overall, we have had to lower our standards significantly. It's another argument, I think, for why we need a more robust GI Bill to bring in a better quality of recruit and make that recruit smarter over time.
Online here from David in Cottage Grove, we have officers who spend most of their careers just going to school, then get out. They don't get shot at or dirty. Fair complaint?
I don't think that's fair, not at this point. Not 5 years into the Iraq War, where most people have done at least one deployment. And like I said earlier, more than 500,000 have done two. I think we've got about 40,000 people who've done four deployments. So the officer that hasn't deployed and has spent their career of the last 5 years in the close confines or the comfortable confines of an educational environment are pretty rare.
That's unusual.
Even the folks teaching at West Point right now, most of them have done at least one tour in Iraq or Afghanistan.
You know, I saw a statistic recently when I was reading up for this show that said how few West Point graduates are reenlisting, that they go do their, you know, the stint that they're required to do, and then they get out too.
They do. The class of 2001, was considered kind of a benchmark class to see how the retention affected that class. And I think only a little over 50% of them have decided to stay in beyond their minimum commitment. So we're losing a ton of captains. We're losing a lot of non-commissioned officers in the staff sergeant range. And we've got to think long term about whether or not we're going to have an Iraq hangover, whether the Iraq war and the demands on our force are going to impact our ability to respond to Afghanistan, to domestic threats, and to threats yet to come down the road.
Are you satisfied with the amount of attention that those questions that you just raised are being given in Washington? Are they thinking enough about this, and are there some original ideas coming up about it?
No, they're not thinking about it nearly enough. I think most of us who continue to serve and deal with veterans are extremely concerned with a hollowing of the force. There is a debate about whether or not the military is broken or breaking, but no matter how you cut it, you have to admit that we're under tremendous, unprecedented stress. And the number of people that we have is just too small for the number of jobs we've asked them to complete. So over time, we've really got to reevaluate our force structure. I think increasing the overall size of the active duty makes sense, and I think most military and foreign policy analysts would agree, but getting there is a lot tougher, especially when we don't have robust educational benefits and other incentives that can draw people in. We've got to think not just about Iraq and Afghanistan, but about the 25 and 30-year horizon down the road.
Paul, always good to talk with you. I hope you'll come back.
My pleasure. Thank you very much, ma'am.
Paul Rykoff with us, Executive Director of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. He served in Iraq, joining us this morning from New York. We're going to take a break for news, and when we come back, continue our conversation. Cindy Williams is going to be with us. We're going to turn the focus a bit. We're going to still talk about the GI Bill, but we're also going to talk about some of these incentives that the military are now offering and the arc of the incentives, how it began when the Iraq and Afghanistan wars began, and how they keep amping up the incentives to try to bring more people into the military. Cindy Williams has some thoughts about what that means for the standards and the quality of the military, and I'd like your thoughts on it as well. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. If you're in the metro area, you can reach us online as well. We've got full lines still, minnesotapublicradio.org, and click on Send a Question. Other side of news, back to your calls and questions to the newsroom in Perry Finelli. Hi, Perry.
Gary, officials in China's Sichuan province say more than 7,600 people are dead after a massive earthquake in central China. Hundreds of students were reported trapped under the rubble of their school. The quake emptied office buildings hundreds of miles away in Beijing. Damage assessments are being conducted in northeast Oklahoma and southwest Missouri, where tornadoes left more than 20 dead. Officials in one Oklahoma town of about 800 people might not be rebuilt. Six people were killed, more than 150 injured there by a tornado Saturday night. Storms have moved east, causing flooding and power outages and prompting evacuations. In the mid-Atlantic region, up to 4 inches of rain have fallen across the area since yesterday afternoon. A sinkhole of up to 30 feet wide and 10 feet deep has forced the evacuation of three homes in the Washington suburb of Camp Springs, Maryland. The field of presidential candidates is growing. Former Republican Congressman Bob Barr announced this morning he is running as a Libertarian. Some political analysts believe his candidacy will hurt Republican John McCain. The Libertarian Party's national convention begins in 10 days. Governor Tim Pawlenty has long been considered a possible vice presidential nominee, and now the Washington Post says he's number one. Pawlenty landed on a list of five possible vice presidential nominees to run with McCain in November. Authorities are looking for two men who stabbed a Burnsville man several times, set his home on fire, and stole his car over the weekend. The victim is recovering at Hennepin County Medical Center. Investigators are not sure why the fires were set, other than to possibly cover the suspect's tracks. High temperatures around the state today, mid-50s in the north, 40s near Lake Superior, 70 for southern Minnesota today, some scattered rain showers in the north. Right now in the Twin Cities, 53, and the skies are mostly sunny. It's 10:33. This is Minnesota Public Radio News.
Minnesota Public Radio's budget year-end continues Wednesday with a special challenge. When 500 listeners contribute by 9 a.m., Minnesota Public Radio will receive an additional $5,000 for programming. Tune in Wednesday morning and be ready to meet the challenge.
Support for this program comes from WCCO 4 News. Tonight, Dennis Doda is curious about how healthy sport and energy drinks are and wonders if they do what they say they do. On Channel 4, tonight at 10.
We're back on Mid-Morning on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Carrie Miller. Coming up tomorrow morning at 9, we talk about the influence of money on politics, how money coming into the campaigns, the way it has, a lot of money coming in over the internet, is changing the nature of the campaigns. Will it change the nature of government once a new president is elected? We're going to talk about that tomorrow morning at 9. At 10, paleontologist Neil Shubin is going to be with us from Chicago. He's out with a new book called Your Inner Fish, fascinating story of fossils that he and his team found up in the Arctic, what it says about how life moved from water to land. This ought to be fun. Neil Shubin with us tomorrow at 10. I hope you'll listen in for that. Back to our conversation this hour. But first, let me tell you about what's coming up on Midday. Former Senators Roger Moe, Dwayne Benson are in to talk with Gary Eichten about the big issues on the final week of the legislative session. I'm sure you heard Tom Scheck this morning saying that time is running out and much needs to be done. So Gary talking with Roger Moe and Dwayne Benson about that. And then at noon, a discussion from the UBS Forum on the partisan divides in friendship and politics. Okay, now back to our show. And Cindy Williams joins us for a conversation. She's a research scientist with the Security Studies Program at MIT, and she's author of the book Filling the Ranks. And Cindy Williams, thanks very much for being with us. Cindy, are you there with us? Okay, I think we'll... Hi, Cindy Williams, are you there with us? Okay, I think we do not have her locked in yet, so we'll figure that out. Let me go back to the phones. 800-242-2828. If you're listening in the metro area, 651-227-6000. If you're online, minnesotapublicradio.org, click on Send a Question. Shall we try this one more time? Cindy?
I'm here.
I'm glad.
Thank you very much, Carrie.
Thanks very much for being with us. I want to ask you first, we're going to talk about some of the incentives that the military is using to get people to join. But I do want to ask you about this GI Bill. The Pentagon opposes it, and so does the DOD, and so does the White House, because they're concerned you give generous education benefits and people are not going to want to re-up. They'll do their minimum stint. They'll get out. They'll go back to college. Paul Rykoff, our guest for the first half of the conversation, doesn't buy that. How about you?
Well, I buy it. The Pentagon right now, especially with the Iraq war going on, is having trouble getting Army people to re-enlist. And their reenlistment rates have declined since 2003 when the war in Iraq started. And the Army, the hallmark of the all-volunteer Army that we've had since 1973 when the draft ended, is that the Army tends to keep people for a second term of service. So if they signed up initially for one term of 4 years, typically they'll extend for another 4 years. Often the Army pays a reenlistment bonus to get them to do that. But it's those second-term people who really form the backbone of the U.S. Army. And if they start walking away because they see a more generous college benefit there at the end of 4 years, that's going to be detrimental to the Army. Now, the Congressional Budget Office did an estimate last week of what the retention change could be, and they see a potential for a 16% decline in Army reenlistment rates as a result of this GI Bill.
Would you say then that really buttresses the argument that you give people incentives on the way in, but you don't dangle them for the way out? I mean,
I think that's right. I think especially, you know, we do have a big incentive for people to leave at the end of 20 years,
right,
which is called the military retirement benefit. That's really, it's quite generous and makes people want to leave. And most people leave shortly after the 20-year mark if they made it through the 20 years. Now, one thing that's interesting is that Senator Webb is the author of
this
bill and the most interested sponsor of it. You know, he's a former Marine.
Right.
And the Marine Corps thinks differently about these things. The Marine Corps wants people in for 4 years and then out. And they aim to keep no more than 25%
of
their cohort. They see themselves as a young force, a boots-on-the-ground force, a force that where a lot of the work that they have to do, a lot of the fighting that they have to do, can be done and is best done by the most junior enlisted people. The Army, on the other hand, sees its non-commissioned officers, these sort of mid-level people, as the backbone. And so it's a different philosophy between the two services.
Well, tell me then why you think they've come up with this. I think this came up in February. It's getting some attention now, this $40,000 for a down payment on a home. I mean, that sounds to me like another reason to get in, do the minimum, and get out so you can buy a house.
Right. And I think there were a lot of people in the Army, people who think about Army personnel policy, who were opposed to that idea. So, there are differences of opinion within the services, and certainly differences of opinion across the services about how to do this. But the thing that Army force managers typically want is they want incentives that will help them create the force they want. Mm. And so they want incentives that will help them keep people in for as long as they want them to stay, which typically means more than the first 4 years. They want incentives that will draw people in, period.
Yeah.
And then they want incentives that will help them draw people to the specific careers inside the Army that they need filled.
What
if they need information specialists, they want to add a bonus recruitment.
So be strategic.
Go into that, yes.
Okay. Well, what about the idea, though, and Paul Rieckhoff makes this argument, that you educate people, you give them these education benefits, and many of them, if they're not going to stay active duty, they will stay in some form of reserve, National Guard, something like that, and you're getting the benefit of having more educated citizens, and, you know, which is good for the economy.
Well, one thing to know is that the Army already does have a very generous educational program for the people who want to go to college and that it most wants. So the Army is already, for the people it most wants, it's already willing to put up $70,000 for those people in an educational fund. It already is repaying student loans for people who will join, up to $65,000 total, depending on whether the person is going into the career field where they need them the most. So there are already programs like that. So yes, it would potentially help in terms of education, but you're talking about an extremely expensive way of doing that.
You're talking about a
total cost of something like $50 billion over the next 10 years.
Right.
$5 billion a year. It goes up to $7 billion a year in the later years. A total cost of that doesn't help you one iota with the size of the force, because everything that you gain in recruiting is you're going to lose in retention, according to the Congressional Budget Office.
Let me go back to the phones here, to Stephanie in Minneapolis. Stephanie, I thank you very much for waiting. Your comment for us.
Thank you. My brother is just retiring from the military now, after over 20 years, and he's still having to struggle with the benefits. They're not that great. He had to give long, hard thought to where he would be able to go to school and still afford to live. So he settled on Texas because they had the better benefits.
Mm-hmm.
He would have liked to have stayed in Virginia, but he did not feel that he could afford to go to school and live there. And, you know, I just feel like people who are serving deserve to have an education. You know, what they're offering now, you couldn't go to the University of Minnesota with that benefit.
Cindy Williams, that's what Paul Rieckhoff says. We owe this to
right,
the people that have served.
I know when people talk about this, they often go back to the World War II experience, mm-hmm. and they say, you know, we made this possible with the benefit that we gave to GIs after World War II. But the difference there was that we had largely a draft force during World War II, and people were paid dirt wages, especially at the entry level during World War II. Today, people are paid a living wage if they're in the service, and their wages are quite favorably comparable to pay in the private sector for people who have a similar level of education and similar number of years of experience. So they can save for college, too. They can save for college in the same way that civilians save
You're
for college if that's their...
Because they're making enough money to do that.
Because in contrast with World War II, they're earning a living wage today.
Let me take another call here from Tom in Brookings. Tom, thanks for being patient. Your question or comment for us?
Well, this is wonderful. I've been listening to all this. I'm a Vietnam era veteran, and I did use my benefit while I was on active duty, and I still finished a 23-year career. But the point I wanted to make was mostly about the cost today. When I was an undergraduate back in the 60s, my tuition and fees for the whole year were $300, and I worked at Ford Motor Company over the summer. And in 1 month, I had enough money saved for my everything for education
wow.
for a year. And, I mean, you think about that today. I don't think this proposal is out of line at all, considering what the cost of education is today.
Cindy Williams, we haven't talked about that. Is this, and I think Paul Rykov makes this argument and other supporters do, that you have to keep up with what it costs to go to college these days, which is a lot higher than the World War II generation.
Right, but there are really two things going on in this new GI Bill idea. The first is about the cost of tuition. And basically the GI Bill says, let's about double the amount that's available for tuition today under the current GI Bill. So today under the GI Bill that already exists, mm-hmm. a person can have $1,000 a month toward education, toward tuition expenses. This would raise it in most states on average to about $1,900 a month, so maybe $900 a month more, maybe $800 in your average state. But the big kicker in this plan that Rykov and Webb are interested in
right.
is that you would also pay people a housing allowance during the time that they're going to college.
Living expenses.
Of mm-hmm. about $800 a month. And that's where the real added expense is coming from. And so, I mean, I think we have to ask ourselves seriously whether that's something that we're prepared to do. Or are we prepared to spend an extra $2.5 billion a year, not just now, but forever, for anybody who joined the military during this time? Is this what we want to do, and not get anything extra back from it for the force managers who are having to deal with these problems in the Army?
I want to ask you, I want to find out what your thoughts are on what we're getting for the incentives that seem to grow more generous as the wars go on, that the military is offering. When I looked at Slate.com put up a chart of where it, started and where it's gone to, and it shows, bonuses for quick ship and enlistment, training bonuses, depending on the kind of training that you get. Student loan repayment, you mentioned that, 401k contributions, lower education standards. I mean, they're lowering the, taking more people that don't have high school degrees. They're getting more flexible on age. We've talked about the $40,000 on the down payment. They're doing legal waivers if you've been in trouble with the law. What's all that add up to? What are we getting for all of that?
Well, first of all, it depends on who you're talking about. Some individuals are getting enlistment bonuses as high as $40,000, but not everybody gets that. Again, that's the tool that the Army is able to use to attract people to go into the jobs that they need filled the most. So not everybody's going to get that amount. But what it adds up to is, to my mind, one-time good deals for people. Mm. So the taxpayer pays it now as a cost of the war, but it doesn't have a long tail. In other words, 10 years from now, I'm not still going to be paying that cost the way I would with this new GI Bill that these people want. So, to me, these are good sort of ways that the Army, tools that we can put at the Army's disposal to manage the force. Now, is it enough to attract all the people that the Army wants?
People that the Army wants.
So the Army is getting the number of people it wants. Last year it made its numbers, but the quality was severely lower than it had been in years before the Iraq War, and it fell in the high school dimension, it fell well below the Army's benchmark. The Army wants 90% of its enlistees to be high school graduates, literally have a high school diploma, not a GED.
Mm-hmm.
And last year, they had 71%. So they're suffering in that regard.
I thought you had an interesting take on this when you wrote about it in American Interest magazine a while ago. You said that while there are always going to be opportunities for the higher quality troops that are in the military, you say the lower quality troops who entered in recent years may find fewer reasons to leave of their own accord. The quality problem in the enlisted force could thus persist for years or even decades. So you're saying they're bringing in a lower quality of person than they want, and these people really have no incentive to get out. They'll be there for a while. Implications of that?
Well, that's exactly right. They may be the very ones who decide to stay. And to be honest, they may be the ones who find it difficult to get into college and aren't going to find the college GI Bill to be of much benefit to them. So, these people may decide, assuming that they get through 4 years of military service, they may decide that, yeah, the military is a pretty good life for me compared with life on the outside. I'll stay here.
What's wrong with that?
Well, it wouldn't be a problem if you had 1 year's worth of people like that. But now we're up to 4 years' worth of people like that. In other words, four entering classes that are operating sort of below the Army's normal standard. Now we're headed toward a fifth year like that. So now you're going to have a big slice of the Army's non-commissioned officers, potentially, who are not up to snuff relative to the ones that the Army would have had in mid-career just 5 years ago.
Online here from Jeff in Shoreview, we can't afford an Army that accepts CAT-4s or felony waivers. I courts-martialed 24 substandard soldiers my first 6 months of command. What do you think about these legal waivers that the Army is doing? A sign of, some would say it's a sign of desperation.
Well, the Army has always had a waiver program. And in fairness, there are people who get into trouble at age 16 who are going to be complete stand-up citizens by the time they're 18. And so the Army does need some process to look over these people and say, that, yes, he made a mistake. She made a mistake in the past, but she's still going to be a very good troop, right? The Army, unfortunately, has doubled the number of people who are coming in under those kinds of waivers. And so one has to start asking, what are the long-term consequences of this? And actually, the Army started getting enough data in that they can start to sort out what some of the differences are. And what they're finding is people who came in under the waiver programs, they're more likely to be discipline problems, like this online commenter says. And they are actually more likely to desert than their counterparts. But if they make it through and get through their first couple of years, they're more likely to be promoted more quickly than the others. So it's almost as though they were risk takers, they're still risk takers, and you need a certain amount of that to do well in the Army, but you also need to follow the rules to be in the Army. And so there's this tension between the two for this group.
Let me take a call from Bob in Minneapolis. Bob, thanks for holding. Your question or comment for us?
Good morning. I'm just wondering if there's something similar to what I experienced back right after World War II for the retained people. I worked in what was called, I was just a flunky clerk, in the Armed Forces Education Center in Tokyo, a whole building. They enrolled people through Madison USAFI, United States Armed Forces Institute. They could get all kinds of college credit. And this was back when everything was written and was by ordinary mail. In this whiz-bang electronic world of satellite streaming video and what have you, there could be a lot done for the people who are actually in service. You'd spend a lot of time waiting. You wouldn't do it if you're on foot patrol.
So getting your education while you're deployed.
There, way beyond military subject matter, anything you wanted. You could practically get a degree a part-time for no money at all, just as a ordinary sergeant in an occupied city. Maybe a USAFI center in Baghdad when the firing calms down might be advisable.
Cindy Williams, should the Army...
The caller is exactly right about this. And in fact, all four of our military services have very generous programs for getting your education while you're in service. They reimburse tuition. They have courses that are held right on your military base. The Navy now has courses that you can take on ship, and they even have professors at sea, a wonderful program for training face-to-face, in addition to what the caller mentioned, the electronic training tools that all of the services have now. So that's another reason to want to stress the educational programs while a person is in service, while it can still pay off for the military, the educational opportunities that are being made to individuals and to the individuals.
I have a couple minutes left, but I wonder if you think there is enough thought being given in Washington, in the Pentagon, in Congress, in the White House, to the kind of army that we need in the future? Or are we so caught up in the needs of two ongoing wars that nobody can really take a breath and look ahead?
Oh, to be honest, I think everybody's looking at it. The problem we have right now is that people are of two minds about it.
Oh.
So you have sort of the David Petraeus, the general who now is in charge of the Iraq war but is going to be in charge of Central Command. You have his style of thinking that seems to go along the lines of the Army needs to be better at counterinsurgency and to be basically a counterinsurgency and peacekeeping force. But pushing back against that, you have more traditionalists who say, look, the Army has to remain a full-spectrum Army because one day we may be involved in a major land war of the type that we used to talk about, a much more traditional type of military against military fight. And you have elements inside the Army debating this every day. You also see that we have elements in our political leadership debating
right.
this every day, and it's not a question that's going to go away.
Is it a conclusion that you can't have both? You do have to choose one or the other?
It's a conclusion that it's difficult to have both. It's difficult to equip a military and to train a military in a way that it can do both. And right now, you know, the Army is putting so much into the counterinsurgency and nation-building effort in Iraq that nobody is having time to train. In fact, the Army's turned its main big Army training centers into centers to train for people to go to Iraq. So there is very little training for the other kind of war, the traditional kind of war.
Sounds like a good topic for a conversation. We'll put that on the list. Cindy Williams, thanks very much. Good to have you on the program today.
Pleasure, Carrie. Great to be here. Thank you.
Cindy Williams, research scientist with the Security Studies Program at MIT, and she is the author of Filling the Ranks. As you know, we talk about books when we're not talking about other subjects. Tomorrow, an author, different kind of book, though, a paleontologist, Dr. Neil Shubin, with us. His new book is called Your Inner Fish, and he writes about these trips that he has been taking to Ellesmere Island, getting ready to go on another expedition up there, where he looks for fossils. The fossil that he found several years ago, he named it. We'll talk about that, and we'll talk about why he believes this fossil that he and his team found tells us about how life came out of water and began living on land. So we'll talk with Neil Shubin. That's tomorrow at 10 o'clock. And while I'm talking about books, don't forget about the spring season of Talking Volumes. We've got Michael Ondaatje launching our spring season. This is going to be fun. 7 o'clock on May 27th at the Fitzgerald Theater. Of course, he's the author of The English Patient. He's a wonderful poet. And his latest novel is just a great read. It's called Divisadero. And we'll be talking with him about the newest novel, The English Patient, the poems that he writes and the poems that he reads, and a wide-ranging conversation. He's got such an interesting background. Born in Sri Lanka, lives now in Toronto, Canada. So, Michael Ondaatje at the Fitz on May 27th at 7 o'clock. Judy Blume rounds out our spring season. She's going to be with us June 12th. Tickets for both of those shows are selling quickly. If you'd like to be in the audience at the Fitz on the 27th or the 12th of June, I'd suggest you get your tickets now, and it would be good to see you there. And I want to mention our book club. We've chosen our mid-morning book club selection. Comes to us from a number of listeners who say this is really John Irving at his best. Great narrative skills, favorite books, books that our listeners go back to over and over again, and it's John Irving's A Prayer for Owen Meany. I've never read it. I've read a lot of John Irving's books, so this is going to be fun for me to read it for the first time, too. I hope you'll read it and join us. We talk about it on June 27th. This is Mid-Morning.